Lectionary Lab Live is recorded in the studios of the 405 Oxford Group, Gainesville, Florida, and Brasstown, North Carolina, a Two Bubbas and a Bible production.
Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man, good to get up with you. We're going to talk a little text. We're getting ready for the sixth Sunday after the Epiphany. These are the texts for February the 16th, 2014. We enjoy working with these texts. And today we have actually options for five texts. We have a text from Sirach. Where shall we start today, Bubba, as we preach? We've got a fairly long gospel reading today from Matthew. Don't know how you feel about the way it supports or interrelates with the other texts, but why don't you just lead us on in?
I think we'll start with the gospel. I think right now, the lectionary itself being driven by the Sermon on the Mount.
Absolutely.
Late Epiphany, a long Epiphany, and we're just working our way through that. Mm-hmm. And it's a long, we're kind of having week after week a conversation about what is the role of the law in the Christian community.
Right. And that's a good way to look at it. That's a helpful framing, I think.
One of the things I wanted to say is it's always interesting to discuss the law in the Christian community in terms of what part of the law some people want to apply. And some people at one end of the scale say, well, it's all been replaced.
Right.
By the New Testament. You know, that's the Old Testament. We don't have to worry with that. And there are other people who want to, I think, at another end of the scale, kind of don't differentiate anything about it, mm-hmm. kind of unaware there are things there that they aren't supposed to be doing. They just say, it's the Bible, it's in there, we're not supposed to do it.
Right.
And then there are people in the middle that I call kind of selectively pick. And I think the part of Hebrew scripture law that they like to apply is those things they don't like that other people do.
Hmm. Yeah. We all kind of have our own helpful filters, don't we?
Yes.
The way we pick it.
Particularly if you're going to play around in Leviticus, it gets dangerous.
Right.
So it's always important. This is an important thing. As Jesus is doing these things in the Sermon on the Mount, in which he's talking about, you have heard it said, but I say to you, to get at what he is trying to tell us about the law. One of the important things to note throughout all of this is how Jesus ups the ante. Just last week, he had said, not a jot or a tittle, not a stroke of the law will be removed. But immediately he goes to talking in ways that can be said, well, you've heard it said, but I'm going to add too.
Yeah.
He said, I won't remove, but now it sounds like he's adding too. So what is going on? Well, one of the key things that's happening with Jesus in Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, is he is trying to talk about what some people think of as heart religion. He's talking about some of what we've been dealing with Isaiah in recent weeks, and some other texts about not just having surface religion of ritual religion, but having real life lived out social justice issues. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is saying the same thing. It's not enough just not to murder. You've had to deal with the anger and the hurt and the broken relationships underneath. It's not enough to just not have relations with somebody you're not supposed to. You need to deal mm-hmm. with those inappropriate ways of looking at other people as sexual objects that break a relationship mm-hmm. and create bad relationships and on. So this whole text to me is a one that's basically said, when he says, you have heard it said, I hear him saying, it's not enough to stay at the surface of not behaving badly. Mm-hmm. You have to go deeper and think about the growth and maturity as a spiritual person.
I think we all, it's a human tendency to say, what's the least I need to do to be okay? We like to, you know, to minimize things. And I see Jesus taking us deeper here, expanding here, saying, look, I know you've heard it said, don't do this. And you think you've got a pretty good case built for saying, well, see, I didn't do that. He is taking away our tendency to minimize. What's the least I can do and still be on and still be okay? And rather than heaping up additional commandments here, rather than adding a lot of stuff, it's an expansion in a different sort of way. I like the way you put it.
Right.
You're going to need to face up to this.
Right.
You need to probe deeper. We're not just trying to keep a list here. We've sort of had that running dialogue the last few weeks, too. This is not taking one set of commandments and swapping it for another. This is not that kind of ethic here. It's not just a list of rules. He's not just adding two in that way. It is expanding. It's fuller. It's richer in a way, a richer kind of life he's describing, this life in the kingdom.
And one of the things, there are two things in this text that leap out and really bother people when it's read in worship. And you have to find a way, you either deal with it directly or indirectly. And one of those is all the self-mutilation stuff. And the other in most of the mainline churches in the modern culture is the divorce issue.
Right.
I want to say a little bit about both of those. One of the things you have to look at with the right eye calls you to sin, tearing out, and some people say it's hyperbole, exaggeration. Well, not exactly. It's more along the lines of an illustrative piece that is, if, say, cancerous, if your right eye was going to kill you, you would have to take it out.
Hmm. Yeah.
If it were cancerous. You know, they think of this as in terms of cancer.
That which is harming the body's got to be removed.
Yeah. Rather than dying. If your right hand causes, now he's playing, throw it away. It's better you lose that than your whole body go to hell. There are a couple of things going on here. Jesus follows right on the issue of looking with lust in your heart and committing adultery here. Mm-hmm. And his real concern is, Jesus said, this is serious business. Jesus is saying, this is important. You have to take care of that, get rid of, deal with that part of you that makes you think in those ways.
Mm-hmm.
And if this thing is going to ruin your life, don't you want to get rid of it? And he's talking about that. He's not talking about cutting off your hand or gouging out your eye. He's making it important enough to hear that this kind of lust is the same kind of thing.
Yeah, he's calling us to realize that something's going on deep down in your heart, in your mind, in your spirit. Something's going on there, and that's what you need to get to. That's the thing that, very much like a cancer, is going to grow, and it's going to steal the life. It's going to steal the life from your relationships. It's going to steal the life from literally the way you live, whether that's family, whether that's at work, whether that's at church. These attitudes left unredressed are going to grow, and they are going to kill you. And so I think you're exactly right. He's urging us to look much deeper.
So when you deal with the question of divorce and only for adultery, and I know the way that's been worked out was worked out for many, many years. There were a lot of loveless marriages because of the inability to get divorced.
Mm-hmm.
What Jesus is addressing here is the fact of the casualness with which a Jewish male could divorce his wife. One of the rabbis said, well, if you find another woman that looks better than yours, that's a cause for unhappiness, and you're able to do a certificate of divorce,
right. Mm-hmm.
Et cetera. So Jesus didn't introduce anything new. He just took the hardest line that was there already in the Jewish community. But what he's really, it's not by accident that it's tied in with this middle discussion about adultery and things, because underneath it all is the sense of saying, if your only sense about this is your, I don't want to call it physical pleasure, mm-hmm. but is of the carnal level, then you've got a serious problem that leads to looking at others with that kind of thing, or being willing to dismiss your wife and not caring about what her needs are. And this is why Jesus lifts it up and says, if you're going to be married, you're going to be in relationship. This is all about relationships, this entire gospel lesson. You have to get to a more serious level. I'm not talking a solemn level. Mm-hmm. I'm talking a serious level that takes seriously being honest in relationship, caring for the other person, treating them with respect, treating them as they should be treated. And this whole discourse is about all kinds of practical ways in which you need to get below just doing the expected thing, the thing that'll get you by, but going down deeper into what's getting genuine in all relationships.
Well, you're helping us dig in here to some important questions. And this is not necessarily, or this is not an easy passage.
It's a hard passage.
Yeah. I am struck by something. And if it's okay, I'd like to take us for just a minute to the sermon that's posted on the lectionarylab.com this week. And you mentioned, or you used in that sermon, a helpful technique for preachers sometimes, especially when you get a passage like this one that's pretty expansive. It would be very easy to start trying to chase down each one of these lines and explain them. And before long, if you're not careful, you've got a long, long list of things you're trying to work your way out of, and people aren't sure exactly which direction you really do want to take.
Right.
And so you used a technique that I know we teach in our workshops sometimes, that rather than trying to deal with a whole passage, sometimes it's helpful just to lift up one part of it and to just go ahead and understand there's no way I'm going to deal with everything that's in this passage in one sermon, and certainly not today. But here's what I am going to talk about today. Can you talk about that a minute and maybe just a little bit of why you approached it the way you did in the sermon on the lab this week?
Well, for one thing, as you look through this and what I've just been talking about, this is a laundry list of things put together, and, you know, I'm not sure whether Jesus preached it in this order. I don't think so. I think that my own personal understanding of the New Testament, I think Jesus said all these things. Matthew structured the gospel that was written, where all of this came together and put these pieces in this. But all of this, to me, this pericope then picked by the committee, is around that a particular issue, but it's a group of things that the original writer put together. And as you say, you can't deal with all of them. But what I think with a text like this is pick out something to focus on that helps you get at the larger issue in the entire pericope. I picked the piece about the gift at the altar early on, 23 and 24.
Right.
And you're remembering your brother or sister has something against you. Because I think that this entire text is about going beneath the rules into relationship, getting beneath what you have to do in order to, you know, kind of pass on doing the accepted thing, and getting deeper and deeper into relationship. And I preached a sermon relative to that, and then sort of applied that principle very lightly on the rest of the text as a way of getting a sermon on this text that gets the point, I think, without trying to deal with everything through it, because it's just impossible to do.
That's it.
And often you'll find that, particularly in Lent, we're going to have these long Johannine texts, that it's going to be important to start looking for those kind of pieces, a place you can hang your hat on, but you're preaching a theme that flows throughout the story, throughout the big text.
Just a good opportunity to point out that, homiletically speaking, it is extremely possible to miss the forest for the trees. You can take a passage like this and go point by point by point and work out great explanations and set these commandments in their context and bring them forward and chase all kinds of things and perhaps go right by an important point like the one you just mentioned. Sometimes we need to get beneath the rules in order to get to the relationships.
One of my old Baptist preachers, mentors, called a sermon, one of those sermons on a long text like that, he called that a skyscraper.
A skyscraper. You know,
pile one story on top of another.
There you go. Just stack them up.
Seven or eight stories high, then you get to the end and talk about Jesus and the cross.
You've made
an illustration about every point throughout this long text, but you haven't really said anything coherent.
Right.
You know, that's sometimes what we end up with.
Yeah.
If we could, I'd like to move along to Deuteronomy and the Psalm in particular.
Absolutely.
In connection with this, how do the commandments work out? Because I think throughout this Sermon on the Mount, the writer is trying to reposition Jesus as a new lawgiver, but one who revives, I think is a better word than recapitulates, revives the law, not creates a new law. the theme of Torah, of law, that I think needs to come more to the fore in the Christian community, is we've had too long of contrasting the law kills, you can't get saved by the law, and all this, which is true from a Pauline understanding. We've too long had that, and we haven't paid enough attention to Torah as teaching, as Torah giving life, as Torah being God's gift to us, of Torah being a way in which that God has gifted God's people. And Deuteronomy text really helps us get at what the ancient Hebrew people understood the law really to be about in its best sense, an exhortation to choose life, an opportunity to have a way to live a good life. It has lots of these wonderful contrasts here between life and death, prosperity and adversity, obedience or straying and disobeying and following other gods. And again, that thing, I have laid before you the choice. Choose life. That's just a wonderful sermon. Now, some people have a problem with it because it's a too Arminian. We had a lot of conversation about Arminianism in our workshop this week. We had a predominance of Methodists.
God bless them.
That's a little too free will. But for for most of us, even a Lutheran like me, we understand there are choices people have to make. Mm-hmm. And the Torah was giving an opportunity for people to have a choice. And this is where the Deuteronomy text can tie. Or perhaps, sermonically, you might want to go with Deuteronomy, which is just a wonderful text.
Yeah, it's a very straightforward text. And I wrote about this in our lectionary lab commentary. Again, I flip back to that sometimes to see what kind of thinking I've done on this passage before. We live in a time in which the both and choice is alive and well, and it serves us pretty well. There are a lot of situations in life, instead of having to say it's either or, it's possible for us to say, well, it's both this and that. But this is right. Not one of those. This is really not one of those. God is trying to be clear, I believe, in communicating here in Deuteronomy. You cannot both serve God and follow the path to bow down to idols. That's just not a choice we're going to be able to make. And rather than casting it negatively, which some people do, oh, look at all these things God says God's going to do. God's going to punish. God's going to chasten. God's going to do this. I like the tone you're encouraging us to take here. God is saying, look, life and death are before you. That's the way the world works. Choose life. This is what I'm giving. This is what I'm offering. Choose life. And it's very much the positive choice that is set before us here. The commandments, the law, the guidelines that God gives, that's exactly what they are. They guide us in the positive choice. They're markers along the way. This is how you can tell you are, I guess you could say, walking the right path. So use it as a positive choice, albeit a very straightforward one.
Always be aware of who's sitting out there, and there's a world of hurt sitting in your pew.
Yep.
And, walk softly with that. But there is, all of us have various ways in which we can choose life. The gospel is, most of us don't have all the strength we need to make our appropriate choices.
Right.
And we need God. It's not baldly out there, but as our good Methodist friends would say about their prevenient grace, God gave us the Torah, then told us to choose. He didn't put us in an empty room and made us choose out of nothing.
Right.
We have it laid before us. We have some options. Even in that kind of free will, we have those choices that God has encouraged and given us options. And even moving into folks like the more Lutheran understanding of this, we still know that God is very present and lifting us up as we make our choices and giving us strength to make the choices we need. This is a great text for that kind of sermon.
Yes, indeed. Look
at it. Sirach, it's an option if you're an Episcopalian. It's mm-hmm. or use the expanded
Hebrew canon.
Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very similar. If you choose, you can keep the commandments and to act faithfully as a matter of your own choice. This would not be something Lutherans would preach. It's more too complex in terms of our understanding of free will to use this text. But it is laying out the same kind of thing, that there's some options you have in terms of choosing life. It might be used illustratively.
Yeah. I will say that it's a very nice turn of phrase in verse 16. It's a vivid image. He has placed before you fire and water. Stretch out your hand for whichever you choose. I mean, that's pretty vivid. Let's see,
pretty obvious.
Stick my hand in the water or stick my hand in the fire. And it just, again, is an illustration of this is the way the world works. Every choice has a consequence. It may be a consequence you desire, or it may be a consequence you wish you hadn't gotten yourself into.
Interesting the way these texts all feed together with one another and trying to struggle with that question of how do we make good choices?
That's it. Well, let's change the pace just a little, although it's certainly helpful in our considerations by looking at the portion of Psalm 119 that we have today, the opening verses in Psalm 119. You want to talk about positive? We start right out here. Happy are those whose way is blameless. Happy are those who keep his decrees. Help us think about this psalm a little bit, as how it fits in our preaching for today.
Psalm 119. No, I used to joke about using it on what I called Get It Over With Sunday. In the old Luther Book of Worship, there was the Athanasian Creed, which takes up a couple of pages. There are a couple of For All the Saints hymns that have 17 verses.
Yeah.
And Psalm 119. How many verses does it have?
A bunch of them.
Yeah, all the way through. It's 8 times 22 is what it's got.
Yeah.
And so we joked about sometime in the middle of July, I have a Get It Over With Sunday, just using all that really long stuff on a Sunday when nobody would be there. One of the interesting things with the word that's translated here, happy, is also the same word that's often translated blessed. The translators go back and forth, both in the Hebrew and then in the Septuagint Greek version, and then in the New Testament, in Matthew in Greek. It's all basically based out of the same word, blessed or beatitude. And the happy translation is more along the lines of contented rather than giggly.
Right.
You know? And sometimes I'm about how happy face and smiling and all that. That's not what this means.
Mm-hmm.
This happy is more like it was a happy accident, or a happy as a person is content and at one and at peace with the universe. It's related to shalom. That's an important one to think about here. One of the tie-ins is verse 4, you have commanded your precepts to be kept diligently. Oh, that my ways may be steadfast in keeping your statutes. This poem is tying back to the whole notion of living a good life and being in relationship with God and your neighbor is rooted in the spirit of the law, not so much the letter, as it's said elsewhere in the Gospels. And this psalm is based in that.
I see this introduction to Psalm 119 as fitting in with a theme that we have been following for several weeks now, and fits on this day as well. If Jesus is trying to lead us to look beneath the rules to the relationships, it is about leading us into a fuller expression. And when you talk about the relationship of happy here to shalom, there's a real sense of that in being full or weighty. The richness of life that God desires for us to have, it does not come from checking rules off a list. It comes from allowing Torah, allowing the law to lead us in the way which is life, the way which is full, the way which leads us to shalom. And I very much see this introduction to Psalm 119 as fitting in with that. Let's finish with our 1 Corinthians text for today. A little more along this, who's your favorite preacher, which has been part of the discussion that's been going on.
It is, but interestingly enough, although we're following continuous reading in 1 Corinthians right now, and it's not picked to tie with the other, I see a tie, which has to do with that introduction where Paul is talking about can't speak to them as spiritual people, but rather as people of the flesh. And he's not talking there about carnality, about, only wanting to feed the flesh, but of being people who think only of physical things and aren't lifted up to thinking about spirituality, I guess. when he talks about, I fed you with milk, not solid food, and you're not ready for the solid food, he's talking about teaching. And he's basically saying, I taught you the rules, not what's underneath them, because you weren't ready. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, I think with your children, you know, you teach them, don't teach the stove. Eventually you teach them what hot means. You work on it. You know, right. What are the basics? And early on, it's because I said so, kind of teaching. And get the rules down, and then you come back and you learn what's underneath it. Or with writing early on, you just got to learn basic grammar, whether you understand the rules behind it or not. Once you get that down, you can begin to explore the logic and the reasoning behind it. I think in some ways, we learn the rules or the law, and then we can move deeper in knowing about how this is about relationship and about genuineness of heart. And that whole business of milk and solid food seems to tie in with that with me. The other thing, I love verse 6, and this is a good reminder for a church that maybe is not feeling like it's seeing the results of its work. Mm-hmm. You know, they're working hard at various things, and it doesn't seem like they're not getting a lot of wins, you know, as a congregation. This is a good text to talk about. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. The kingdom of God's a long-term project.
Very long, and God's working is certainly much longer and happens in a different time frame and perspective than ours. I think this passage is interesting in terms of our overall theme of relationships, and it is the relationships that matter. One of the things that challenges our relationships a great deal is the issue of jealousy or of looking at what somebody else has or what someone else has done. We see that expressed in churches, especially over time as pastors may come and may go. And this argument is still alive and well. Well, you know, Apollos was a little better preacher than Paul. Yeah, well, but Paul, you know, we liked him because he was a really good teacher. And I've heard that in churches looking back. Yeah, well, when brother so-and-so was the pastor, it was good like this. Yeah, but then the next one comes along and yeah, we liked him. Look, this is not about sides, folks. Pastors, we don't need to feel threatened by our predecessors or our successors. And congregations, we don't need to have to feel like we need to justify who was our favorite. God called Apollos to water. God calls Paul to plant. It is God, though, who is growing the field. Paul uses the image here of the field. You are God's field. God is building you up. We're all on the same team. Let's just put that other stuff aside and let's get back to the relationship.
We are, too many of us, we clergy are people pleasers, and we get our energy off of people telling us we please them.
Yeah,
that's and right. We worry a bit too much about them not being pleased. That's confessional on my part. Mm-hmm. But once upon a time, about 20 years ago, I came to a definition of when I was okay with my church. And that definition is, if the check don't bounce and nobody's actively trying to fire me, I'm going to sleep well tonight.
I'm happy tonight. Oh, my
And it
goodness.
Has worked out for me for the last 20 years. And I quit worrying as much about whether they liked Apollos better than me.
That's it. One more thing, the image of the field. And again, this is for us as pastors. We need to remember that when we come in from the field at the end of the day, there's really one person to whom we need to give account. It's God who's going to be saying, how did it go in the field today? It's God who's going to be the one saying, well done, good and faithful servant. Or, you know, I wish you'd have worried a little less about what Sister So-and-so was trying to tell you. It's good stuff. Bubba, I want to thank you for helping us think through this week. And we look forward to continuing through the rest of Epiphany. Won't be that long until we'll be ready to start Ash Wednesday, the season of Lent, and getting ready for Holy Week. Meanwhile, we're going to keep working the field here at the Lectionary Lab. Thanks to everybody who's listening, and our prayers and blessings, best wishes go to all who will be preparing to preach the Word this week. Bubba, I don't reckon there's much else left for us to do but to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
I look so awfully tragic?
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Mama Told Me by Frank Anea. We go out this session with Put On a Happy Face, performed by Dick Van Dyke and Janet Lee from the Broadway musical Bye Bye Birdie. Lyrics by Lee Adams, music by Charles Strauss.
Pick out a pleasant outlook, stick out that noble chin, wipe off the full of doubt look, slap on a happy grin, and spread sunshine all over the place. Just put on a happy face. Flowers? Put on a happy face. Put on a happy face. Why do you mope around so sourly? It's such a strain. I always try to chuckle hourly. It clears the brain.
I knew a girl so gloomy, she'd never laugh or sing. She wouldn't listen to me. Now she's a mean old thing.
So spread sunshine all over the place. Put on a happy.
So put on a happy face.